All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Hello and welcome to the Read Rothbard podcast. We are a day late and a dollar short, or many dollars short, probably. I have Robert with me. How are you doing, Robert?
We don't have any dollars. But I'm doing good. Okay. I'm on my normal telephone, but it is, I think it's dying. I don't know. It's crapping out on me. Hopefully I sound all right.
Is it one of those phones from back in the Ma Bell days? Or is it one of those free market phones that's failing?
It's not that old, but this phone was purchased, air quotes, purchased, at a public library, sale, I guess you could call it, like a fundraiser.
And, so it's like an old library phone?
No. It's like something, like people donated a bunch of crap, and then like, hey, library rummage sale to support the public library.
Oh, okay. So it doesn't have the used in a public library stank on it. It's just got fundraiser stank on it.
Right. It's got fundraiser stank on it. It's a voluntary way to support something if you particularly happen to enjoy libraries.
Right. And the friends that I've talked to about free market and anarchism have all said, well, what about parks and libraries? Don't you like libraries? Don't you want kids to be able to read? As if all of a sudden they wouldn't be able to read anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a disconnect because everything that you enjoy, people would find a way to provide that. I mean, there's no law that says you have to have a supermarket provide food, but magically it happens.
Yeah, so that's our free market lesson for the day, kids, boys and girls.
Yeah,
hey, speaking of kids, I've got one of mine with me, so she's going to be a bit of a guest on the show. We can probably hear her in the background. She's beating the crap out of one of the little baby dolls that she has, so that's pretty fun. And it also brings to mind the topic of today's show, which is the Hunger Games, where they take kids from different districts and pit them against each other in a fight to the death for the entertainment of the entire country, I guess they would call it. What is that, Pan Am?
Yeah, the country of Pan Am. It's like, what, once a year they grab two kids from each district, and then it's a gladiatorial fight to the death, murder fest, where the one person who wins, what are they? They go on like a propaganda tour, or they like get to move to the capital. I forget what was the winner's prize.
The victors, they get a victor's house in their district, but then they also, I believe, go and tour all the 13 or 12 districts. I think there used to be 13, and then they wiped one of them off the face of the earth, and then all the other remaining districts think that there's only 12. But plot twist and spoilers, 13 did survive, and they just live underground like mole people. But they conscript, basically do a draft of two non-volunteers to come from each of the 12 districts and fight to the death. And this is a method of control for the populations. It's like you were saying, gladiatorial. So it's, you know, the bread and circuses. It's to entertain the populace, but it's got to be also, you know, horrific to know that two kids from your town or wherever, because they're all relatively small districts, I think, at least as depicted in the movie, like everyone kind of knows each other.
Yeah, the district, the main character's district seems to be like a small town, like a small, like, coal mining town. It's not depicted as, multiple cities or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, the capital is pretty big, but...
But the kids are conscripted by means of a lottery, as I recall. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true.
And do they seem, I forget how it is, but do they take it as like a point of pride or like an honor or a duty of some kind, or is it totally, hey, you need to do this or else you are going to be killed?
I believe that the some of the districts, it's more of a noble thing. You know, they actually train for it, and so they're the districts that are more feared in these competitions or in these games. So it would be, you know, like ancient Greece, you know, Sparta, they'd be the warrior types. And so they would train to do that versus like District 12, where the main character is from, is, you know, like you were saying, a coal mining area, and they're more blue collar. It's more subdued, and they kind of don't want to go, you know, like it's not a point of honor for them. They see how shitty they're being treated by the Capitol, and the Capitol plays favorites. It's roughly an order of whatever their district number is. So District 2 is treated better than 3, 3 is better than 4, and they're in District 12, so they get, you know, kind of shit on. And District 13 got blown up.
And these people are so busy just trying to survive that all of a sudden throwing them into these gladiatorial games means you're throwing basically these people that have never trained a day in their life, or, you know, to be heavy, heavy underdogs against these killers in these other districts.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's through, you know, cunning and some luck and some compassion and all of these things that the main characters survive through, through, I think, two of these events. We're doing the whole series in one show here, or one go, so we're not really breaking it up. But I guess the point I wanted to make, you know, is it's not too different from the draft, the military draft. You know, they're pulling people out of the population against their will to go and do something that they don't want to do. That means they need to go kill someone or be killed.
Which is the definition of slavery. If it's a contract that cannot be broken by one of the parties, you have no choice. And you are the property of the people that are conscripting you. So these people wouldn't be said to be free in any sense, just as we are not free in this country or basically any citizen on the planet. Because at any given time, a government could just institute a draft. And you give all the guns and all the power to one person or one group and say, limit yourself to not do X, Y, and Z. That's just insanity. At any given time, they'll just be like, well, there's a Reichstag fire. There's a Gulf of Tonkin incident. We have to go to war for whatever bullshit made-up reason. And we need cannon fodder, and we own you. So for the glory of the homeland, you have to go fight and die, and we're going to rob you of your entire life because they draft the youngest among us. And it's horrifying. So it's essentially, I mean, if you're talking about allegories, I assume it is a very strong allegory for the draft. Would you say so, Daniel?
Yeah, I would say so. And also the surveillance state, it seems as if, or the police state as well. It seems as if they're always under surveillance, and everything they do is seen and known. And there's what they call peacekeepers. So it's also the Orwellian deal where, you know, whatever the name of the thing is, it's kind of, its purpose is the opposite. So the peacekeepers are the actual, you know, on the ground grunt enforcers of the rules and of the oppression that is meted out by the Capitol.
Right. And unfortunately in this story, the bad guy isn't the machine itself, is it? Or it isn't the belief in authority. It's like this snow guy. Isn't that the goal, is to kill him at the very end?
Well, there is a bit of a twist at the end, and I only know this because I just recently watched the last two of the films. But yeah, it's the typical, you know, it's not the system itself that's bad, it's the person, or it's the bad apple.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they blame snow and a lack of democracy. And so District 13, which is where Katniss ends up after a little while and discovers that place is actually still around, they have a president there as well, and she helps lead the resistance against the Capitol and uniting the districts against them. And towards the end of the film, Katniss realizes that Coin is just going to be the next figurehead, you know? So you cut off one head of the snake and there's another head. And Coin's going to be no better than Snow was. And so spoiler alert, at the very end, at the execution of Snow, she's going to shoot an arrow at him, and then Coin is actually up on this podium or this pedestal behind him, and she raises it up a little bit higher and shoots her instead, President Coin. And then the crowd kills Snow. But the thing that... Say that again?
So she shoots this Coin person?
Yeah.
And then the crowd kills Snow. And so these two presidents are killed. And then that's it? It's over?
Well, then they promise to hold free elections. And the leading candidate is one of the military commanders who is featured in the movie. And they say that that person's likely to win because they've been the voice of reason and whatnot. But, you know, it reminds me of the Road to Serfdom, you know, the rise to power. Like, you get this populist to come in and overtake someone who's seen as failing or being too authoritarian. And then if that fails, then you get a military person. So I can see that Snow and Coin were both going to be bad, but they don't take the system on as being bad other than the system of doing this gladiatorial combat with the conscription of the kids, you know, this Hunger Games thing. Like,
so the Hunger Games gets abolished, and they see that as an evil, but they don't recognize democracy as an evil.
Yeah, they mention many times that they want to instill a democracy so that everyone has a choice and everyone has an individual freedom, which is weird because it's totally contradictory. You know, those two concepts, they don't go together.
Right.
Like, how is my one millionth of a vote or whatever me exercising my freedom? If anything, right. it's one millionth of me exercising my freedom, you know, or whatever the numbers actually are.
Right. So how does the book end? I mean, does it end like kind of ambiguously? They don't know who's going to be elected.
It actually ends with, we assume the election happening and this military person getting into power, and then, you know, society being just and moral and everything's right in the world. And then it goes into the future a bit, and Katniss is with that PETA guy. They now live in District 12 again, and they've had some kids, and she's talking to her infant, her second kid, is like, oh, you know, I had nightmares, and someday I'll tell you why I have nightmares. And, you know, there's fun games to play, but there's also really terrible games. And then it ends.
So,
like I said, you weren't missing much by not watching the last one.
So takeaway, I mean, I remember that from the book. Full disclosure, I read the books probably like 5 or 6 years ago, and I've seen all the movies except for the last one. But... Yeah, my memory is being tested here a little bit. So it's kind of a takeaway would be, like, democracy is good. You just have to get the right people in, and democracy needs to be implemented correctly. Is that the story here? Because one thing that all horrific atrocities in history share is that they've all been legal. So it's like, just because a bunch of people say that murder is okay doesn't make it okay. But the Hunger
Games... Yeah, changing the law doesn't change the morality of whatever the act is.
Right.
I mean, with any law that's implemented, like yesterday this wasn't illegal and tomorrow it is, well, was it moral before or is it now somehow a different morality now?
Right.
And yeah, so that's kind of a Larkin Rose thing. You know, one of the other things that came up in the last film was the instance where Katniss decides that she's going to kill Coin, and that's because Coin did a false flag attack against her own people. So they had got all of the people in the Capitol fleeing towards the government or the President Snow's mansion. He's promised them shelter and safety and food and all these things. And so they got all these people in one mass area, and then they had a false flag where they had an aircraft with the Capitol's insignia on it drop gifts down to the crowd. And the gifts end up being bombs, and they kill all these kids and the medical personnel and all of these people, and it was used as a propaganda piece to get the rest of the Capitol's guards and army to finally turn against Snow because they thought that Snow slaughtered all these innocent people.
When in reality, it was this coin person.
Right.
So
yeah, so it was a false flag to get the rest of the military to stand down and stop
as
fighting.
As I recall, Katniss's sister was one of the nurses in that and was killed in that attack. Is that right?
Yes, yep.
Okay, so it became personal for her at that point.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you could argue, some people would argue, that this is akin to the atom bombs being dropped in Japan. So, though, yes, it is a false flag, but it did potentially stem ongoing fighting and continued military battles.
You
so,
the end of the war, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it effectively ended the war, whereas the war may have dragged on further and more people may have died. Yeah, it's a very pragmatic and iffy argument, but I think that's the argument that people make about the bombs dropped on Japan.
That's the, okay, so that's, is that Beth Coyne's argument? Does that ever get made in the book?
Well, she saw it as a strategy to win the war, so yeah.
So I'm going to kill a bunch of kids and then rally everybody against this guy because he's bad. And then we'll win, and then I'll be the leader, and I'll be a good leader because I kill kids or whatever. So it's, yeah,
right.
Ends justify the means, and, right, a small horror to prevent a bigger horror, I guess. Right? I guess.
Right, yeah, that's the story. That's the delusion that they tell themselves.
That's pragmatism. That is the unchecked pragmatism of essentially government and leaders. That's their thinking. Can justify any horror with essentially unchecked pragmatism. You got to be tempering unchecked pragmatism with morality and principles.
Yeah, that's what's so great about the line of thinking that we follow now, and it took a while to get to, but it does allow you to see things through a certain lens and decipher them and sort of understand things a lot better. I think for me, things came into clear focus, you know, what's good and what's bad, as long as you apply some basic universalizable principles to them.
Right, and we get criticized for being dogmatic and not being realistic or whatever, when really that's just whining of people wanting to be more pragmatic about things and bend on things. Like, we both took a quiz recently that was like this, how good of a libertarian are you kind of quiz. And
yeah, what's your score?
I took it, and you know, the maximum score was like 160. And it took all of about a minute to take that quiz. I don't know. There were like 60 questions, and it was just like, yes, 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 yes. I mean, I could quibble about the phrasing of some of these things. Like, for example, like, would you want to reduce taxes by 50% or more? And I could have easily said, no, I want to eliminate all taxes. But technically, yes, I do want to eliminate by 50% or more, meaning 100%, so yes. But yeah, I thought that was a really easy quiz, which I got 100% on. But it was interesting to find out that a good friend of ours got much, much lower, but still got some, so that's positive sign.
Yeah, what was his score? 39, is that right?
39, but he said if he rearranged some of the, or changed some of the wording, that he got like a 75.
Well, okay. Not bad.
If he was able to change some of the wording, but no. But still, that's positive.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, this is, I found this quiz on the Tom Woods private Facebook group page for being a donor. And actually, I think it would be a cool thing for you to go and become a donor yourself, Robert, so that you would have access to this, because it's full of 700 or 800 people who pose questions and articles to the group and get all sorts of feedback. I see a dozen things on there every day. Like, people are super engaged, and they're all, you know, real high on that spectrum. So in the short time I've been on there, and I haven't really said anything, but I've been just seeing it, it makes me feel far less alone out in the wilderness, as we are, you and I.
Yeah, there's, I've seen some criticism over the years and again recently about how people that are, you know, fairly dogmatic or fairly principled don't challenge themselves. Like, you just get into like a certain mode of thinking and then you look at the world through this lens and then you don't ever challenge yourself, so you never really grow or anything like that. And I think that's a decent argument to make against most people, but I wouldn't throw that against libertarians. I think libertarians are unique in that, or at least in my experience, unique in that we constantly challenge ourselves. We're constantly saying, so now what? How would the NAPD apply here? What about this situation? What about that situation? We're constantly doing things like that, constantly testing the limits of our philosophy. And I don't know if I have a real point, but I just wanted to defend libertarianism against being overly dogmatic or what have you. I think we are dogmatic, but we're constantly testing those principles against all sorts of imaginary and real situations. Generally imaginary, but also real.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree, and this could turn into a longer episode just like that, because I have a lot that I would like to say. But I could leave it at I agree, I'll just, fuck it, let's go. Let's go. Let's do this
a
little bit.
Go, and you can chop it up how you want.
Yeah, so being dogmatic simply means that you have principles that you hold dear, and you hold yourself to. And so people who are unprincipled will often try to make arguments based on pragmatism or scientific studies or cite your source, you know, where's your source for this, where's your reference for that. And that's just, a pissing match between who can get the most sources or the most reputable sources or whatever, when the morality and the philosophy behind any action is not really up for, scientific measurement, or some article was written in this magazine or this newspaper, and therefore, you know, this is some evidence or whatever. Am I making any sense? Like, people's mode of argumentation these days is cite your source. Oh, okay, you've got these sources, I've got those sources. We're still at a stalemate.
Right, right. And like we've said in the past, two pragmatists arguing back and forth will forever be arguing back and forth, because it's always, well, my sources and my data support my argument in this way, and I think it's best, and the other guy will be doing the exact same thing on the other side, and never the twain shall meet.
Yeah, exactly. And then the other thing about challenging ourselves, I think that libertarians did challenge themselves, and that's how they got to become libertarians. Like, they saw that the normal mode of looking at the world wasn't right, and so they had to come to discover a method by which you can view things that is more correct. You know, I think that we have found a truth in the non-aggression principle and many of the tenets of Austrian economics, and then you just apply those throughout, and then you gain a better understanding of things. And additionally, it's because we're pragmatic and dogmatic, or sorry, not pragmatic, we are dogmatic, it is sort of like a specialization. You know, the more time you do something, the more learning you put into something, the more effort you put into something, the better you get at it. So people who aren't dogmatic, you know, wishy-washy, going back and forth, they can't specialize. You know, whereas once we've found libertarian philosophy, we can specialize and get really, really good at it.
And we tend to be less contradictory. There are so many times where you will look at a politician, and of course politicians are contradictory by their very nature. They will take one stance on one thing according to some opinion poll, and then a completely opposite stance on another thing according to an opinion poll. They're basically just going with whatever way the wind blows on any given thing.
At the given time that it's, right, that it's expedient or necessary to further their grasp in power, right?
Right.
Because like 10 minutes after it's served its usefulness, they'll change their mind again.
Right. But even among normal people, just like the average person on the street, without a set of guiding principles, they're essentially the same. They will contradict themselves repeatedly. They'll be completely authoritarian on one thing and then completely anti-authoritarian on another. They'll say, well, hey, nobody has the right to tell me, you know, what drugs I can put in my body, but then I have the exact right to tell what other somebody else can do about some other thing. I can't think of something off the top of my head, but what you can and cannot do with your body about this thing or that thing. You know, whether you can wear a seatbelt or not, or whether you can smoke in a restaurant or not, or, you know, they it's completely an unprincipled thing, and it's completely, really pragmatic. Like, I think I should be able to take drugs, and I don't want anybody to smoke near me, so I'm going to use the violence of the state to force other people not to be able to smoke near me, or what have you, whenever I go out into public, because I don't like it. Well, if you analyze that, it's two opposing principles, but it's completely pragmatic. So you'll find that people contradict themselves on a routine basis. And libertarians still do, to some extent, which is why libertarians are constantly arguing with each other and trying to figure things out.
Indeed, yeah. I do recall the smoking in inside ban in Washington State. It came about 10 years ago. And I will admit that I prefer being in a smoke-free environment, and so there has been some benefits to that for me personally, but I don't agree with the method in which it's imposed. You know, it's fines and laws and enforcement when they could have just left it to the free market to, okay, you want to have a smoking restaurant? Fine, you've got one. But that's a competitive disadvantage compared to this other restaurant for people who don't want to be around smoke, and vice versa. You know, if you want to be able to smoke, go to this restaurant. It's like different strokes for different folks. That's what the free market is.
Yeah,
but instead, when the government gets involved, it's the same fucking stroke for everybody.
Yeah, whether you want it or not. And it doesn't allow, like you said, it doesn't allow for restaurant owners to appeal to different parts of the market. You may have an entire group of people that would love to get together and just smoke it up, but you can't do that because you'll be facing a gun in your face if you do. And that just, it allows for less differentiation in the market. And it allows for less customer satisfaction.
Yep, everyone must be the same, must conform. And that's what's funny. Like, they impose these top-down rules and restrictions, especially leftist types, yet they decry that the entire country looks the same now. Like, you know, you can be in Orlando or you could be in Boise, Idaho, and it's the same six stores in the strip mall, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a result of this way of thinking, you know? Like, they'll blame the free market on that.
Right.
But I would say that most likely these larger corporations are preferentially treated and are therefore protected from competition because they have more of a hold on the reins of power and they're cozy with government. So they do make it harder for their competitors. And so that's why you'll see the same six or eight stores in every strip mall across the country.
Right.
But that's all going to go away soon anyway. Like Amazon's kicking their ass.
It's true. Amazon is kicking their ass. But you'll see big corporations in favor of some sort of regulation legislation because they can handle it, whereas the smaller competitors can't. So exactly what you're saying, you'll see the same six stores, the same mega conglomerates that are able to take the hit that knock out the smaller competitors.
Yeah, yeah. Another thing the leftists whine about is like Walmart and the minimum wage, and they seem to assume that Walmart doesn't want the minimum wage. But in reality, they actually support it because what it does is it makes it harder and harder for competing stores to compete in the markets, you know?
Right.
Like they want to make it harder for someone to unentrench them. So of course they're going to be good with it.
Right. And they won't come out and say that. They'll say that they're for the minimum wage because they call it like a living fair wage or whatever. And they'll virtue signal in their commercials about how much they care and what have you, when in reality it is, an anti-competitive measure.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hey, maybe we can start wrapping this up. I've got a couple of things that have been going on the website that I can tell everyone about. I did mention the Tom Woods group that I would suggest that you look into, Robert. But we've also got the Tom Woods Liberty Classroom. We're an affiliate for that. So if anyone wants to check that out, click through our link. And we'll get a little commission, so that's nice. Another thing I wanted to mention was we've launched a Amazon affiliate store for readrothbard.com. It's up in the top left corner right next to the tip jar page. So there's a little link that goes to the bookstore, and it's got all the Rothbard books. You just click through and make a purchase, and then we get something like 4%. So, you know, it's not going to break the bank or anything, but if anyone's interested in Murray's books, buy them through us, and we get, you know, a little kickback.
Raw and uncensored, Murray.
Raw and uncensored, just like this show. So what have you been working on, Robert, as we're winding things down here? We usually do a little update with you.
Yeah, so just been pounding away on the book, finishing up, finalizing, polishing up these chapters that are, you know, I'd say about each chapter is probably around 75 to 80% written, and now I'm just going through and finishing them off. So it's been challenging but rewarding. I'm doing it in a very linear fashion. So right now I'm on chapter 5, and things are going really well. And I've also started a series of images that hopefully are very simple, and they just point out that, you know, the causes of people committing atrocities, the belief in authority causes people to go against their own conscience by believing that the person telling you to do a thing has any right to tell you to do a thing, when in reality it's just a threat. You do this thing or else. So you get things like honor killings, and like feelings of duty that cause people to go do horrible things. Like, I'm doing this for the good of fill in the blank, the collective so-and-so. So much of that has caused all types of untold pain and murder and horror throughout human history. And I'd just like to do a little thing to hopefully shine just a tiny little light on that fact. So there's a series of images, and right now I've just got 3 of them, and they're almost done. But hopefully those will get put up on the website soon.
Well, that sounds cool, man. And thank you for the update. So that's about it from us, folks. We've been the Reed Rothbard Podcast. We run ReedRothbard.com. We got lectures, books, articles, this podcast, and much more at ReedRothbard.com. And thanks for joining us. This is episode number 21. So thanks again. Have a good night.
Take care, everybody.
Chipmunks, C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K, we're the chipmunks, guaranteed to brighten your day, do-do, do-do-do-do, do-do, do-do-do-do.